as I said, good evening. Good to see you all, those who I can see. Good to see the names of those whose names I see. And for those who just joined within the last 30 seconds, I want to just reassure everybody our end time for this evening is 9:30. We will not go over time. If I am mid-word, I will stop at 9:29 and 59 seconds. Lene there, those last two words were a little disquiet, but that's where we are. I'm going to share my screen with you, and we're going to do something a little different this evening. This two-part series is Out of the Depths, Halakha in the Midst of Crisis. And what I'd like to do with you this evening and next week is something very, very specific, but addressing a larger question, which is really something that we did deal with in the electricity series in a micro sense. And the word crisis is key here. Now, what does crisis mean? And I'm happy to have your input. What does it mean to have a crisis? What kind of words come to mind when you hear the word crisis?
Panic.
Panic. That's a good word.
Wife.
Did you say life?
Wife.
Wife. I see she's not sitting next to you at the moment.
She heard.
Oh, okay, good. That's interesting. So it's interesting, the word crisis, if you were to ask me generally what comes to mind, I would say obstacle, difficulty, challenging. But the truth is there are things in life that are difficult that are not crises. As an example, Norman might say a wife, meaning I wouldn't call it a crisis, might be challenge, difficult, marriages, maintaining them, relationships generally are challenging. We have things we need to work at. But even waking up on time in the morning, that can be difficult. But if I said every morning getting out of bed was a crisis, you would probably recommend a level of counseling for me. I shouldn't be engaging crisis that often on something routine. And the truth is, etymologically, the word crisis goes back to a Greek term for something that means decision, making a decision. And that's something we tend to do often. We make decisions. But crisis is the kind of challenge that makes you make a decision. Getting up in the morning, I don't really decide to do that. If I'm in my routine practice, it's a challenge, but I get up. I'm not making that choice. A crisis is when you're at an inflection point where any act that you make is a decision because the norms have been shattered. Your expectations are gone. Everything has ended. We spoke about this at length over the last few months before the shutdown. Shabbat afternoon, about what modernity did to the Jewish community who had spent 500 years behind ghetto walls. The ghetto walls were gone. Europe said, the European powers said, Jews, you are emancipated. However short-lived that nice intent was, they said, you now can come out, the ghetto walls are gone. At that point, Jews had to make a decision. There was no choice. They had to make a choice. They had to either build those walls back up and hide, or engage with the world in a new way they'd never done before. They had no choice. That's a crisis. A crisis doesn't necessarily have to be horrific, traumatic, but it's an inflection point. In fact, Rabbi Sachs has a nice piece about the Hebrew word for crisis. Anyone know the Hebrew word for crisis?
Matzav.
The matzav, interesting. Colloquially, that's sometimes used to mean crisis. Matzav means a situation. So if you're in a crisis, you say the matzav, talking about the situation. But in a vacuum, the Hebrew word for crisis is mashper, which is something broken. Mashper means something's broken. But what else is mashper in Hebrew? Not used very frequently, unless you're in the OBGYN departments of hospitals. It's a birthing. And Rabbi Sachs says a mashper, often people think the association is because giving birth can often feel like a critical moment for the human body, crisis mode. But also, again, on some conceptual plane, a crisis is often an opportunity. And this is spoken about at length by a number of people, that in the Chinese lettering symbols, the same symbol for opportunity is the symbol for crisis. And that's really what a crisis doesn't have to be traumatic. Sometimes it is, because the norms that are shattered put you into such a difficult place that you have to make a decision. Either way, We are, I guess, on some level, going through a national global human crisis for the last few months. And what we have seen, when we spoke about electricity, we mentioned there was a crisis, but that was a promising crisis. Technology had erupted and shaken the norms. What do? We need to make a choice. Can I use electricity on Shabbos or not? And if I say no, I am making a choice. What do? And we explored over the course of 5 weeks and 400 hours what we are to do under the moral and ethical guidance of our scholars to deal with this crisis. And we now find ourselves, as I said, in another crisis. And we have another flourishing of material. Here we have, I've got just a still from the YU website. These are Piske Corona, meaning responsa legal rulings from Rav Shechter relating to Corona, number 44, number 45, number 46. Again, 200 years ago, responding to issues on the Yamim Noraim, which we'll be communicating with the shul about in the days to come. Rav Shechter has written a piece about what you can skip, what you can't skip, how you should do it. Laundry on the 9 days and tefillah on Tisha B'Av. Can you do laundry in an age when you can't go out to a laundromat if you're living in the Heights and that's how you do laundry and you can't have it all done in advance? He deals with mourning customs of the 3 weeks, where Rav Shechter actually suggested, I noted in the email we sent out a couple weeks ago, that he thinks listening to music this year during the 3 weeks should be allowed because we are all in a state of morosity. We're all in a little bit of despair. And actually alleviating that might be helpful, even though it's a 3 weeks. So again, what we have here is a flourishing of wisdom, application, moral, ethical discussion in the wake of a crisis, because norms are gone. Things that operated by routine have been shattered and we need to respond. And we had Rav Shechter's responses, which again, I said, 200 years ago, it would have been a letter sent out to the community and pinned up to a wall, which is probably how they're communicating currently in Bnei Brak still and Meir Shearim. But this is up on the website when it comes out. And what we've seen over the last 3 months, Minchat Asher, Rav Asher Weiss, has published 3 volumes of responsa, as you see on your screen. The first one, Mahadura Tanina, the second one, Tlita, the third one, and here it says, Velo Kolol Simanim Shahayu Bamadarit HaKodma, not including stuff from the previous one, meaning there's 3 volumes of material that he's produced in the wake of dealing with crisis, mostly about prayer and not being in the same room. What brachot can you say? And also health issues, of course. Rav Shechter had a number of issues about sharing ventilators. What are the ethics of sharing ventilators? Something the health community had not engaged in a practical level before. Today, I got sent on one of these rabbinic WhatsApps another 3 volumes that have been put together by Rav Zilberstein. As you see here, it says, Pnine Chashuk Echemed, which is the title, Magefet HaKorona, relating to the plague of Corona, Shut V'chizuk, which is Shailat Shuvot, which is responsa and encouragement. We have 6 volumes just on your screen right now, all the responsa of Rav Shechter that are flourishing in the wake of a crisis, because crisis, again, tends to lead, as a shattering of norms, to decision-making. And how do we go forward? And as I've mentioned in the past, the fact that we have a framework in which we have so many norms all the time, which can often feel like a burden. I wake up, I've got to wash my hands, I've got to say Moda Ani, I've got to say a bracha, I've got to be careful what I touch, I've got to go to shul, I've got to daven. All these things can often feel like a burden, but actually, in a crisis, it gives you inflection points and it gives you a chance to wrest control from an otherwise tumbling chaos of anarchy. I now have decisions to make. Okay, I can't go to shul. What am I meant to do? And everybody issues instructions and it gives us a sense of power and agency. And that's what we've seen in the wake of this crisis. And what I'd like to do just this week and next week, as it is a 3 weeks, and I'm sure many of you have heard of this figure, some of you may not have, I'd like to turn to a crisis, which is perhaps the definitional crisis of the past 3,000 years in Jewish history, without exaggeration, since our time in Egypt as a people, perhaps even including our time in Egypt as a people, there has been a singular episode in our history as a people that rocked what it meant to be Jewish. Our expectations were shot along with human beings. Of course, what period am I speaking of? That should be your clue. I'm, of course, talking about the Shoah, talking about 1939 to 1945 in a very limited sense. Of course, things started getting bad way before that. But there's something about the years 1939 to 1945 that were qualitatively different to the kinds of persecution and torment that we experienced as a people up to that point. And perhaps I'll talk a little bit about that on Tisha B'Av around the keynote when we say kinah for the Shoah. But as it stands now, what I'd like to do is not dwell on a description of that moment, because I think we are under enough stresses and pressures that we don't need to be weighed down with that. But what I would like to do is think about, in the wake of the Shoah, some of the existential, moral, ethical, halachic, religious, ritual questions that came up, where decisions had to be made. And in this age, they didn't have, of course, Rav Schachter, Rav Willig, Rav Asher Weiss, Rav Zilberstein, Rav Ephraim Oshri, who's on your screen right now, who I was surprised to find out passed away in my mind recently, 2003. I'm sure for many of you that doesn't sound so far away. I know it's nearly 20 years, but he passed away in 2003. And Rav Ephraim Oshri spent some of the time between 1939 and 45 in the Kovno ghetto and elsewhere. And during that period, he was the halachic, ethical, moral, ritual destination. And he got asked questions from the range of human experience, some of which I won't even mention because they are so graphic and horrific that you need to prepare mentally to hear about those questions. And I don't intend to go down the route of questions that are going to haunt us and give us nightmares, just questions that raise ethical issues in the wake of a crisis. And Ephraim Oshri, he didn't put out Piskei Korona, he put out Shu'ot Mima Makim, with Shalot Tshuvot, questions and answers, Mima Makim, literally from the depths, which of course is where the title for this two-part series is drawn. And many of the responsa, though not all of them, have been translated in a volume called Responsa from the Holocaust. As you see, those are both available. In fact, the Hebrew version, if you're comfortable with it, is available for free on HebrewBooks.org. You can go to HebrewBooks.org and put in the name of the sefer or the name of the author, and all five volumes are available for download. The English version you need to purchase. But Rav Oshri is our destination. What I'd like to do this evening, relatively briefly, is just pick one example, one responsa, one question that he got, look at how he dealt with the question and what that tells us and what we can learn from that decision point, again, from that crisis, that we may not have thought about before. So we'll begin, we'll have a look at this one question. Next week, we'll look at another one, and if it's a very short one, I'll maybe look at two next week. We'll see where we start. But this is the question we're going to turn to this week. This is Siman Chav Chet. This is section 28. Din Matzevat Kodesh Likvarim Harusim. The law of a sacred headstone for burial that has been destroyed. Destroyed headstones is the question, which as I Googled for images, which you have on your screen, and I put in Jewish headstones, regrettably, if you Google that, the first 100 results are headstones that have been destroyed or defaced in the last decade, which is a horrific thing to think about. But of course, the question becomes more pertinent to some degree when we're witnessing a rise of anti-Semitism. But of course, what we're about to read in the question is nothing to be compared to today. It is of a different order. And Rav Oshri's writing is somewhat poetic and efflorescent. And what we'll do is we'll try to read in a way that doesn't necessarily get us dragged into the weeds of the poetry, but communicates the sentiment and gets to the core of the question. Hine, he says, behold, Achrei Asher Eizel Lanu Elokei Yishenu, after God helped us, after the war, and this is purposefully where I wanted to start because the questions from the ghetto are hard to entertain and to read. And this is after the dust has settled a little bit. God has helped us. La'acha shedalunu ma'od v'rav saveinu b'zvat senim yagam l'simcha me'falel argadol. After God gave us some freedom and relief, who brought us from trauma and distress to a little celebration after we were freed from the horrors of the Nazi regime. Yatsati, I went out, Lindod Ba'arima Charevot, to travel around the destroyed city, Shal Medinat Lita of Lithuania. Lechafesh Levakeshet, Sridei Achei Ve'achyotai, and I wanted to find my lost, the remnants of my brothers and sisters, Shenisharu Ku'udim Utslim Eish, like the embers of a fire. Echad Me'ir, Shnei Mimishpacha, firstly my kin, my family, and also those from the city. I went searching, and again, this was not, I don't need to tell you, of course, but we're conceptualizing, this is not an age of Facebook, where you can see post who's still around. You had to physically get on your feet and walk from town to town to see who was around. Varak Az, and because this was not an age of social media, you didn't have people posting images, you didn't have recordings of horrors. Rak Az, only then, after the dust had settled, Nitgale Lefanai, was it revealed to me, Godel HaChorban, how immense was the destruction. And I'm sure for those who had family who were in America at the time, England was a different story, because of course they went through the Blitz, they were more close to Europe. But those who had family in America, you had news about Europe and what was happening with the Jews, but the extent of it was not truly known by the public until after the liberation of the camps and people went to Europe and footage was brought back. And here this figure says, this is someone posing a question to Rav Ashri, and he's recording the words. He said, I only discovered V'chol Naratav and the vast trauma that had been executed and perpetrated on the people. Ki ra'iti be'einai, I saw with my own eyes that aherag acherev achorban sha, Shahazedim ha'arurim, I saw the destruction that these wicked figures had wrought. Asu b'chol kehilot Yisrael, on every town. There was not a town you can go to. And I don't know how many of you have got family who were survivors or who went back to Europe at any point to visit. I went on a yeshiva trip. It was probably about 10 years ago now. And I'd never been to areas of Poland before. And it was astonishing. Every time the bus stopped, you were in a forest where people had been massacred or buried. There was not a town you could go to where the Jewish community had not been decimated. I mean, just in raw numbers, 30% of Poland, 30% of the population was Jewish, and it was all gone. That one in three people had disappeared. And of course, those numbers weren't available to people during the time. And he's now saying, I've gone throughout the land, and I didn't know what to do. My whole body just echoed a cry. The whole of Lithuania was filled with scholars and sages and institutions. Jewish life was alive and vital. Va'ata, and now kulan heinam leot kvarim kvarim. The whole place is a cemetery, a graveyard. V'nidme hayali al shani shomeh kol dmei achinu tzoakim aleinu. And all I could hear was the sound of our brothers and sisters' blood crying out min ha'adama hazot, from this ground. Shine'asta kibikam elea atzamot, that had become a valley filled with bones. And again, it sounds hyperbolic, and I'm not speaking to the audience, of course, you are as familiar with how this is not hyperbolic, but it's astonishing to read this and imagine someone who is not fluent in recent modern Jewish history thinking, okay, it's a turn of phrase, it's a little poetic, but this is literally what continental Europe became, a valley of bones. Again, you go to a forest, and it's not there are neat cemeteries in each forest. They couldn't even put up stones because there was so much death. The Korin Lanu, and this blood calls out to us, Linkomin Nikmatam, to revenge our losses, Mideha Garmanima Arorim, from the cursed Germans, and Mesharatei Hamalitaim, and their assistants, the Lithuanians, Aseid Ram Yimach Shema. Now that was his introductory piece. And again, some of this tenor may resonate with you. Some of you, this may feel vengeant. And distant and detached. But of course, this is written by a survivor in the years after the war. One can't for a moment imagine him writing any other way about this experience. And this is the question. I'm afraid the top of my screen, there we go. Ra'iti az, and this is when I saw the questioner said, Shahatzar ha'ayev lorak sharad et chamal al na'ar v'zakein. Not only did the enemy Shaharag, kill and not have mercy on the young and the old. V'yivarbi Yaakov ke'esh lahava achlas aviv, and set a fire alight among the Jewish people. What else did the enemy do? Hu shachet gamet moado, v'shalachet jado hatmea b'batei moed. They attacked the cemetery. And this is what is so astonishing. You see people do this today, of course, when they deface Jewish cemeteries. It's like anti-Semitism is one thing. You don't like Jews, you're going to attack Jews. Of course, it's unacceptable. But rationally, not to like human beings is perhaps a natural impulse that, if unrepressed, can go amok. But to deface graves, that is a sickness. That is a sickness, to have that cultural antipathy towards another faith or race or group, to assault the dead. It's unspeakable. And this is his reaction here. L'chol chai makom inuchat ha-go'unim, and there were places where the greats, v'ad-tzadikim, ha-dorot she-kadmu, and the righteous of the early years. Again, America is a relatively modern Jewish world. You know, we are fortunate to have many of the pious figures of American history in New York. We have a number of visitors around Rosh Hashanah time here and other Chagim because the Lubavitcher Rebbe is buried nearby. You go to Europe, there are figures who have been buried for 1,000 years. The Rishonim, who we read with awe and reverence, are buried there. And these cemeteries were defaced. Kimat b'chol arei lita, tzion sadeh techarash, the whole place was plowed over. Tzionei kfarim, the headstones, ne'ekrum mimkomam, were uprooted. Va'avnei kodesh, the sacred stone, shalamat sevot, tishbatachna barosh kol chutzot. And he's now citing poetically from verses in Lamentations from Echa, saying they were thrown out into the top of the streets. And I'm sure you've seen the footage where roads were paved with headstones. Not because there was a shortage of raw material, because precisely there was this cultural sickness where they hated not just Jews, but Judaism, and wanted to pave the streets and walk on the headstones that had been given there to respect the dead. And he's seeing this questioner, V'hine ba lefanai mar segel echad, and this person, Mr. Siegel, came to me, says Rav Oshri, Misridi Acherev, who had survived the destruction. Shinsharu lefleve nafsho b'shel ato, and this was his question. Hayod v'horav zachu lamot, and now think about these words. His parents had merited to die. Mot yisharim, a death of the upright. Od lifnei yimei hazam v'chorban, before the chorban, before the Shoah started, they had the luck, the good fortune to die before the Shoah. Uvawel menuchatam bebeit hakvarot, and they came to their rest in a cemetery in a certain city. Aval me'achasha hazeidim hatmeim yimach shamam. But one of these debased people, chilelu et hakodesh, they desecrated the hallowed space, akurat hamatzevot, and they uprooted the headstones of my parents. V'harsu et hakvarim v'no noda ke'et makom k'vod avotav b'diuk ayehu. And this figure comes to Rav Oshri and says, I visited this cemetery, the dust has settled, I can walk around the Lithuania without fear, and I see the headstones have been uprooted. I don't know where in the cemetery my parents are buried. And of course the records have been lost. We don't have the records of where this was. Lachein hu shoel, and this was his question. And again, one has to think about on the face of it, this may seem like a petty question, like figure out what you want to do. But I think this is again exemplifying that when you have a crisis and you need to make a decision, that decision-making moment can give you power to control the situation. Hu shoel, he asks, im mutar, is it permissible, lahakim matsevat even, to put up a stone, al shem avotav, in memory of his ancestors, his family, bebeit hakfarot, in the 70s, be'ezim makom shehu kedei lahakim lehem yad v'shem. He wanted them to have a memorial. They shouldn't not have a headstone. But I don't know where they're buried. He says, can I put up a headstone somewhere in the cemetery for them as a memorial? Me'achasha inen yodeo b'diyuk makom k'vod avotav. He didn't know exactly where they're buried. Shiuchal la'amid alav adam etzeva. He couldn't put a headstone over literally where the bodies were. He wants to know, can I put up a memorial? And of course, this question sounds on its face. You want to make a memorial? Put a plaque up. Why do you have to go to Rav Oshri with this question? But as I say again, giving decision-making moments, ethical power, turning to a sage or a scholar who can channel tradition gives you power, it gives you rootedness, it gives you purpose. And this question turns on the question of dignity, preservation, memory, prayer, and what we'll come to, we'll see, it makes us ask a question which we're not often led to ask, because thank God we are not living through that kind of crisis, which is, why in Jewish life do we have headstones? Why do we have headstones? Why do we have a matzeva? We live in a world, thank God, where we have control over plots, we have control over land, and it's natural to say, okay, I'm going to purchase a plot and I'll put up a headstone, we'll have an unveiling, and I'll ask somebody to engrave a particular verse. Maybe I'll ask somebody what verse I should put on, if I should put a verse on, what words, what dates. But it's just, of course, you put a headstone. But now comes the question, why do we put a headstone up? And by having this crisis, it awakens a question we hadn't thought about. Again, there are all sorts of questions during the last 3 months we've all been asking and had to think about that we'd never thought about before, because they seem so natural and routine. So what I'm going to do in the next 18 minutes is not bake a matzah, but go through some reasons that Rav Oshri cites as to why we have headstones, and then think about what the application would be in this instance. So the first question any rabbinic scholar is going to ask about a Jewish obligation is, what kind of obligation is this? Is this a biblical obligation or is it a rabbinic obligation? And this theme comes up in the electricity series. We had that question earlier in the year when we're dealing with human dignity. That question came up. It is an inescapable question in Jewish law. It's basically, again, lahavdil, is this a constitutional law or is this a congressional legislation, which has cultural significance, a difference, but also legal distinction. And now the question is, in Jewish law, if putting up a headstone, biblical or rabbinic? And luckily enough, we have a source in a Gemara in Moed Katan. Amar Rav Shimon ben Pazi. Rav Shimon ben Pazi says, "Remez litzion kivrot min atara minayin." Where is the hint for a tzion is a signpost. Litzion, where do I know you put up a headstone on graves, biblically speaking? Talmud Loma, there's a verse that says in Ezekiel Yecheskel, Urei Etzem Adam, man will one day see in a field bones, Uvanet Slot Zion, and you will build a memorial there. So it seems like, straightforwardly from the verse in Ezekiel, you build, and Ezekiel is a biblical text, that there's an obligation to build a headstone. And Tosfot on the spot says, Bizmala Zahavim Midoraita, it's a biblical obligation. Seems straightforward enough, we could move on. However, there is a Gemara in Nidah which appears to conflict with that. Anyone know what a kuti is in rabbinic vernacular? So the kutim were a group of what in English is sometimes called Samaritans. They were a group in the rabbinic age, or just before the rabbinic age, who came and en masse converted to Judaism. And there were questions about the integrity of that conversion, whether they converted out of a sense of sincerity to the Jewish tradition or whether they converted because they had an ulterior motive and they didn't always keep the oral law. So the Gemara Nidah says, well, what happens if you go to a Kutite village and you're a Kohen and you want to walk through a field, but you think to yourself, hold on a minute, the Kutites, maybe they don't put up markers by the dead. And I'm a Kohen going to walk through a field where I'm going to become Tame. So the Gemara says, Kutim ne'amanim al tzion. No, the Kutim are believed, meaning there's no headstones. You can believe there's no one dead in the field. Af al gav de midrabananu. Even though it's only a rabbinic obligation to build it, kiven de kipa mizah zeherabeh. Since it's written in the Bible, dichtiv re'ezem adam v'netz al tzion. Since Ezekiel has a verse saying that you have to build headstones, even though they keep it. So what we have two rabbinic texts, one of which is a biblical obligation based on a verse, one of which says it's a rabbinic obligation, even though there's a verse, which is really just saying that's what you should do out of an ethic, but not an obligation, and the rabbis concretize it. And you've got Tosfot on one saying it's midoraita, Tosfot on the other saying it's midrabanan. We're stuck. most authorities rule that putting up a headstone is a rabbinic obligation. Now, having established it's rabbinic, it means we have more leeway, more lenience to think about what you have to and what you might do. So this figure who comes to Rav Ashri, Rav Ashri might turn around and say, okay, the whole discussion is different now because we're talking about something that is a rabbinic obligation, so we can think about being more creative with some of the exceptions. Having said that, we now have to steer from what kind of obligation is it to why. Why do we put up headstones? And I throw that out to you. What options come to mind as to a reason to put up a headstone? Why not bury the dead, say Kaddish, say the eulogies, wait for the grass to grow over and walk away? There were a number of cults in Nordic Europe where some of the kings had mounds, but everybody else was kind of buried in the ground and seen as becoming one with nature. Why would we put up a headstone?
Question of tumah for the Kohanim.
Excellent. So that leads us to the first view. And you'll have to forgive the image. I don't mean to be coy. I couldn't think of a good equivalent. But yes, it could be that essentially this is a do not cross barrier. There is something untouchable here for some people. And really, you don't particularly need a headstone. We've just said most authorities think it's not a biblical obligation. So you don't really need a headstone. What is it? It's basically a public service announcement. Rashi says, Truma won't walk there. And what is astonishing about that formulation is, who are Ochle Truma? Who eats Truma?
Kohanim.
So why didn't he save himself two words in an age when the printing press meant that putting in extra words was a lot of effort? Why didn't he say, Kadosh lo yelchu Kohanim? It says, Kadosh lo yelchu Ochle Truma l'sham. And there are views that suggest that Rashi's concern is not particularly the Kohanim becoming impure. We live in a post-temple world where Kohanim are generally deemed to be impure. The problem here, in theory, is that maybe Truma will become impure and the food will get wasted. That's the assumption here, that it's a public service announcement to stop food, sacred food, going to waste. Rambam has a similar reading, Kadesh Yifrashu Mehem Kohanim. This is essentially to keep Kohanim at bay. So what we're going to see three readings as to why it's important to have headstones. The first one we've just had, as Jerry suggested, is a public service. And again, I'm going to say Lahavdil. This is the ritual equivalent, and maybe I shouldn't even say it in this term, other than to illustrate. Nuclear waste, of saying this is dangerous. If you go anywhere near some of the big desert areas in Western America where they bury America's nuclear waste, you can't get them within miles of it. And there are fences and signs saying, do not enter, dangerous. And essentially, that's what a matseva is. And for Rashi and Rambam, we can put some nice calligraphy, symbolism, emblems on the headstone. But essentially, it's a public service announcement to Kohanim, which in an age of symmetries is somewhat redundant. But that's the first understanding of why we have headstones. There's another reason. And this second reason suggests, and I know we only have 11 minutes left, so we're not going to read it all inside. The second reason suggests the reason we have headstones is...
Identify.
Say again?
To identify who's buried where.
And why would that be important?
For future generations.
Family, future generations.
Oh, wonderful. So you see, if we were giving this share in person and I had a source sheet, I would have the flexibility to go to a source that I had planned for later. But since we have set screens here, I'm going to have to say, we'll come to that in a minute. But excellent. That is exactly one of the impulses we'll come to in a moment. There is another view as to why you put headstones there, which is, let's say a person passes away, unfortunately has no surviving family, so that factor doesn't come up. No future generations are going to come here. No family needs to identify it. Why would we put a headstone up there other than to tell Kohanim, don't come here?
Kavod Hamet.
Say again, Linda, I think you're right.
Kavod Hamet.
Excellent, absolutely. This is out of respect for the dead. This is giving honor to the dead, independent of pragmatic concerns for Kohanim or pragmatic concerns for family. And it's expressed actually very well here by Rav Moshe Feinstein. Essentially, again, we won't read it all inside. He says, in human life, often we bury things. Not just people, we bury lots of things. What are the kind of things we bury in human life?
Seamus.
Say again?
Seamus.
Seamus. Okay, so in Jewish life, we bury Seamus and we bury bodies. That's of the same sort. I've mentioned nuclear waste. That's something we bury to keep away. If you go, I don't know where the big municipal dumps are in New York, but I imagine there's a bunch of stuff that gets buried under heaps of stuff because we want to contain the odor or the smell. It's revolting. Some things, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, burying something is not quite a gesture of respect. It is an ambiguous act. Sometimes we bury things because it's revolting and we want to get rid of it. We don't want to see it ever again. So just burying a body on its surface doesn't connote dignity. And in fact, one of the reasons we bury the dead is precisely because we don't want decay, odor, disease. So how do you mark the gesture of burial as one of dignity, one of honor? And he says, that's what headstones are for. Lo nikar, I'll read the last line. Lo nikar mehekfura atzma. It is not recognized act of burial itself. Shum itzad chashivut v'karod hamet, that I'm burying out of a sense of dignity. That's not clear. It's an ambiguous act. Shalakach shaykh, and that precisely is why. Shiachayvu, we have an obligation. Shiachimu gamat seva, that we have a headstone that we set up. Sharak mizeh, because only if we do that, yada'inan, do we know, shekfurazehu lechavod, that this is a respectful act. So actually, while Rashi and the Rambam seem to put a lot of weight on the pragmatic consequences for Kohanim, Rav Moshe Feinstein, picking up on a long tradition based on the Shulchan Aruch and earlier that I don't have on the screen or time to go into, is that actually it's not just a pragmatic concern for others. This is about giving dignity to the human being, to recognize that we're not burying you because we want to be rid of you. We're not burying you because we don't want to get disease from you. We're burying you because we want to give honor and respect. And of course you have there, I think the word is mausoleum, but I don't know if there's a better word for that, of Rav Yonatan Ben Uziel somewhere in the north in Israel. And I could, of course, put a whole number of mausoleums from Israel and elsewhere or anywhere where you see headstones providing a sense of dignity and kavod to the person who's passed away. And as we go through these possibilities, it's worth thinking about what impact or application would this have to our critical case, where somebody says, I don't know where my parents are buried in here. I would like to put up a headstone to commemorate them, but I don't know where they're buried. So we have to think about how the view of Rashi in the Rambam and the view of Moshe Feinstein would influence a decision on that. And the third and final, before we get to the third and final, I just wanted to note that there is a turn of phrase in Rabbinic Hebrew. If you ever come across a Mishnah in Shkalim or elsewhere where the word nefesh is used to describe a headstone, nefesh usually means soul or spirit. And here there is a discussion if mutar lemeitim. What happens if somebody starts a campaign? We have 6 minutes left, so I'm not going to read it inside. Somebody starts a fundraising campaign to help assist the deceased, and then you have leftover money. You've paid all the grave diggers, you've paid all the pastors and the clergy who are going to help coordinate the ceremonies. What do you do with leftover money? And there's a debate. One view here is it goes to the inheritors. If it was a specific person that it was meant to help. One view is if it was meant to help a specific person, I'm not sure. Adshiavo Eliyahu, we leave it because I don't know if it should go to the inheritors or maybe it was designated for a purpose of honoring the dead. And then there is this view right at the end, Rabbi Yochanan says, Mutar Hamed, if you have too much excess funds for the dead, for a particular dead person, it's not in doubt what to do with it, he says. Bonin lo nefesh al kivaro, build a spirit over his grave. Now, what's a spirit? Rav Avadim Bar Tanur and others say, nefesh mizamat seva in Rabbinic Hebrew. It means a headstone. And here, all I'll say, the Hon Asher, who's a commentary on the Mishnah, says it's not incidental. It is not accidental. It is intentional that the word nefesh, soul, comes in the vernacular of the rabbis to be equated with a headstone, shugoremet shelo yoved zikaron makom gufo ayeh, because it is to establish a permanence for that human being in the same way that a soul gives us animation and permanence on earth in our bodies. The headstone provides us in death with a dignity, a permanence, a position, a memorial on earth. So this is part of that second view, that a headstone is to provide dignity for the dead. The third view, which we don't have to spend a lot of time reading, is you may not be able to see clearly on this image. This is a man bent over onto a light blue painted grave in Israel. I'm sure you've seen images or in person a number of light blue painted graves in Israel. Usually you'll see this in Sfat or other mystical cities where light blue is on the doors and the window shields and the cemeteries. And here you have a man bent in prayer over the grave. And this is essentially what Grace and Jackie said. Why do we have graves? The Chatam Sofer says we have headstones, Kadesha Yuchlu Krovim Levat Krov, so that family members can visit, Litpalel Sham Litim Zumanim, and come there at particular times so they can evoke the memory of the dead, turn towards the dead, which of course raises questions about praying to the dead, which we don't have time to discuss, but seems to be a long held tradition in certain segments. Now, time is marching on, so we're not going to read this all inside. But what I will say, this is the conclusion of Rav Ashri. It says, Mikol HaNizkela El, from all that we've mentioned, and he just, I should say, if you get out the tshuva, he doesn't go through all the sources. He just says, the Gemara in Moed Katan says something relevant, and the Chatam Sofer says something relevant, and I've seen here something relevant. And Mikol HaNizkela El, and from all this is what I determined. So we have to look back at the sources to get what he's saying, and this is what he says. There are good reasons. He addresses all three concerns. Number one, if you have a headstone to keep the Kohanim away and you don't know where the buried person is, so you're going to stick a headstone up, so Kohanim can't go near there now, but there's no one dead there. There's no body there, so that's a problem. So he addresses by saying, actually, Yesh Lichtav, you should write on it as follows, Bebet HaKfarat Zeh, in this cemetery, Nitmanu Avi Va'avi, my fathers and ancestors are hidden somewhere, should be itim shel hazedim, that in the time of the debased Hathorim, the cursed, nevad makam kivram. So you solve that issue by saying this memorial headstone is not marking a grave. That's how you begin, by saying it's not marking a grave, Kohanim, don't worry about it. So having done that, what now happens to giving dignity to the dead and giving a place for the living to come and pray? And what he does in the next two paragraphs essentially is say both those aims can still be achieved, even if you don't know precisely the location of the dead. Number one, giving dignity to the dead. What is it that gives them dignity? Not saying that here lies their bones. That's not what the dignity is. The dignity is that they're remembered on earth, that they are evoked in conversation, they're spoken about, their ideas, their contribution, their piety, their ethics, their life is given utterance. That's the dignity. And he suggests that actually, and I'm not going to read it all in the bottom paragraph, he says in the medieval period where Jews were made to wander and expelled and exiled from place to place, one custom you see in the literature is that they would often gather the headstones and take it with them. The headstones in the medieval period were taken with them to put down in the new place where they went, which of course was not marking where the bodies were, but was evoking a memory that they are still spoken of, still alive. And he says, actually, not only is it fitting to put down a marker, even though it's not where they are, it's even more of an achievement of this aim. Because it says they are not buried here, it will make witnesses think, that's pretty unusual. Why is there a headstone where there isn't a body? And that will actually enshrine the memory deeper in human minds and bring conversation. So actually, by putting a headstone where you do not know where your parents are, will evoke a memory of a far deeper, more profound way that you can achieve. And he says, for the living as well, we don't go to pray by the bones of our beloved because they are somehow magical talismans. We daven by invoking that memory, and we can do that from anywhere. So all that I'll say is, in summary now, because it's 9:30, and even I, some of you may be shocked, even I am shocked that we're finishing on time, but we're going to finish on time this evening, by saying essentially, in this exemplary responsa, just one example, essentially the core question was, even though it was about the details of I couldn't find my parents, I don't know where they're buried, can I put a matzeva up? And we went through three different readings. We went through a reading of the Pasuk in Yecheskel, whether it's biblical or rabbinic, whether this is to dignify the dead or keep the Kohanim in check or to give me a destination for the family. The question at the core of all of it is, do our bodies, do our souls endure beyond our bodies? Are we defined?
Where's it hearing you right now, Linda?
Hearing. That's the question. I don't know where the bodies are. Can I put a marker up? Which, again, concretizes.
What happened when you were walking?
I'm fine now. I'm fine. Just I cannot get up. Everything is hurting me.
So I can't see, I'm afraid, how to... there we go. So the core question at the center of this is, again, which concretizes anxiety for survivors of the Holocaust is, am I more than my body? Do I endure beyond my bodily experience? Am I defined by the pain and suffering and trauma and scars that I have endured? Or can I put a matzeva up somewhere that doesn't mark a body? And of course, the answer is so much more powerful now than just a technical leniency that, yeah, you can put a matzeva up and just write on it that, yeah, this doesn't mark a body. The suggestion from Rav Ashri is, of course, we're not defined by the scars of our bodies. We're defined by our souls, by our legacies, by our memories. And you can put this up as long as you're not tripping up the Kohanim. So you put technical language there to stop that. This marker is far more profound in many ways than it would have been 200 years ago, just marking a body. Because what we do routinely all the time is just marking bodies. And what this crisis has done for Rav Ashri and for the questioner is aroused a question in a radically new way, where a marker, a headstone, becomes more than just a bodily marker, but a pivot for legacy and memory and perseverance and preservation, that now when we go to a cemetery, please God, we see headstones of our beloved and our friends and those who've been lost. We don't just think, oh, here lies a set of bones, but this reminds us of the legacy of a human being who had a life of piety and devotion and care and gave love and time to those around them and has remembered and kept alive despite the body not being here, kept alive by us who carry their legacy. I'm going to stop there because it's 9:33. I do apologize for going over 3 minutes. Next week, we'll look at another example, a couple of examples. And in the meantime, I want to wish you all a good night, a productive night, a healthy night, and a good week. There'll be Parashat Shiel on Thursday. And